the station next week. This is side two of the broadcast, 661, August the 6th, 1984. As I say, Edwin Meese's attorney was here saying in Monterey, because we're a small town and it doesn't travel, we've had a great success. If we remove the name from the media, then as soon as Reagan is reelected, Meese will be your attorney general. It doesn't matter about all the favoritism or anything that went on. Just wait a while and sit it out. And the New York Times had a story July 31st, minding the store from a distance, and it's about Ed Meese, who is staying in the White House, sort of like Paul Marcinkus at the Vatican, that he's staying close. He isn't appearing in Congress since April, when an independent counsel was named. He has shunned the public eye. Reagan's trying to get these important bills through Congress, but Meese isn't seen. He's going to remain in Washington and not get much attention where somebody can yell a question at him. But Edwin Meese's son is stationed at Fort Ord. I mentioned it before. He's a graduate of West Point. He's stationed at Fort Ord. And I don't know whether or not he listens to these broadcasts or not, but Donald Segretti was stationed at Fort Ord when he was ordering the stormtroopers and the chemicals and a lot of dangerous substances distributed and dangerous people distributed. There were Watergate deaths, about 30 that I wrote about at one time, deaths immediately after and during the whole Watergate process. Of the major witnesses were all off. So this is a team that you have to realize are playing for real. The stakes are high, and you sit back and try to praise. You couldn't guess which one or groups or who makes decisions, but I have a pretty good idea. Now, to update a few more stories, and if possible, get to the Reagan appointments. If not, the things I do want to get into the news that we have talked about to update before we lose them. I'm sure you saw on television or read the testimony of Mr. Scotty, Gerald V. Scotty, in terms of the DeLorean case that's now gone to the jury. Scotty claimed that there was a decision made, he worked for the DEA for 10 years, on where to arrest DeLorean. They didn't know whether to do it in New York or Los Angeles, but according to the New York Times, Scotty said someone said something to the effect that this thing is going clear to the White House, that they have Meese in on it. Remember, I talked about Edwin Meese and the DeLorean prosecution and questions about the Meese family and the tangled web of John DeLorean. Well, of course, Meese would deny this. I have nothing to do with this. But Mr. Scotty wouldn't make that up. And he said that Meese was involved in the decision of where to arrest him was taken from Washington, D.C. They didn't know where to arrest him. Now, Mr. Scotty, as I say, worked 10 years with a drug enforcement agency. He was involved in a large arrest in Los Angeles and Miami, a $25 million bust of the Grandma Mafia cocaine charge. And because of certain information he allegedly had let somebody off the hook or informed them, tipped off a person, an attorney, that an associate was going to be investigated by the DEA. So there was some scandal about Scotty. But Scotty may also be blowing the John DeLorean case now by the testimony he gave at the case. He may also be helping the government now to get DeLorean off where the real intention at one time was to frame him. They said they would get his picture in Time magazine. And, of course, Claire Luce, whose husband was the owner, editor of Time, is on the board of Robert Keith Gray. And I want to just diagram for you once again my allegations about DeLorean and the story about Edwin Meese connections. In the Los Angeles Herald in 1982, in November, that's almost 2 years ago, there's an article about John DeLorean. The profit consumed by his expenses in New York was $40,000 a month. The New York office spent $10 million a year. The daily expenses of Irvine, California were $50,000 to $500,000 a day. DeLorean was so busy, he was trying to diversify himself. He was worth $75 million at the time. He wasn't worrying about the car company. He was negotiating with a Utah company, that snow grooming company, where $7 million hasn't been accounted for, and negotiating with the Chrysler, the bus company belonging to Chrysler, and also with a maritime company that operated the ocean-going vessels. And I wondered if the maritime company was in any way linked with Edwin Wilson and his multi-leveled CIA maritime company and the Nugenhand Bank. All of these shenanigans have been left out of the trial. All of this money, the missing millions, the 17 million in Europe or from the Panama banks, the 60 million that Great Britain put into the car company, the 7 million in the Utah company, all of that, it doesn't exist anymore. It's in all the papers, and good investigators found, but forget it now, it doesn't happen. Well, why would Ed Meese want to be interested in prosecuting DeLorean? We've gone into that before. Why would they promise a picture to these men that DeLorean would be covered on time? What was so important? The only thing, I repeat again, was the information I got about DeLorean's links to Mengele's, that Joseph Mengele's was supposed to have been brought home by certain members who were hired to do it, and Mr. Hetrick was flying those planes, but he was arrested on a drug charge and later he wanted to protect his son and Edwin Wilson's son. Edwin Wilson worked with Robert Keith Gray, with George Bush, with Henry Kissinger in Task Force 157, and maybe they didn't want Edwin Wilson's name. You know, since Edwin Wilson's two primary witnesses were killed, his name hasn't been in the news in about a year and a half. Since the DeLorean trial or anything is going on, Edwin Wilson worked with Robert Keith Gray. On the board is Claire Luce of Time magazine. And the mentioning of Meese in the testimony earlier and at this time has a possible link back to these offices of Gray and Wilson and Task Force 157, and particularly with the cover-up of the maritime company that DeLorean wanted to go into, because that's what Edwin Wilson was using as his front for the CIA. Now, the same fellows that wanted to bring Mengele's in from South America that were tangled to this weren't successful. Mengele's would have to be killed. He's carefully guarded, so it didn't work. But the Joseph Mengele story was in the Washington Post, and David Emery sent me a version which I didn't see in my paper. It was there evidently. I read it too fast. It's about the Nazi fugitive Joseph Mengele's, and this is the first time I've seen it in print, except for what I had on my broadcast on World Watchers, on these programs and on the tapes. And I want to show you what Jack Anderson does with it in the Washington Post. The Monterey Herald and the San Francisco Chronicle carried the same story and left out these two paragraphs about Joseph Mengele's that were printed in Washington. He tells about the aliases that Mengele's had, that Mengele's allegedly flew into Miami, that he was tipped off and left before they could arrest him. And Jack Anderson says, and we've had this before, in 1966, the FBI learned that a man named Joseph Mengele, that's the angel of death from Auschwitz who decided who should live or die and did the experiments, medical experiments, in the concentration camp where John Paul II was working for I.G. Farben at the time. He says, in 1966, the FBI learned that a man named Joseph Mengele, a U.S. citizen, was a Nazi party member in America, and as a result was the subject of a denaturalization proceeding, according to a confidential memo. The FBI was told by an informer they wanted Nazi war criminal Joseph Mengele, who was masquerading under the name of Harold Endemann and resided in Riviera, Arizona. And it tells how he dyed his hair and had plastic surgery, which was supposed to have been done at Colonia Dignitat earlier. For a while, the FBI apparently thought it located the authentic angel of death, but like so many other leads and rumors about Mengele's, this one quietly crumbled into dust. Now, it crumbled into dust because nobody will pick it up. Jack Anderson or the Justice Department or the FBI or the people in Miami who are screaming the loudest. The actual FBI report, which I've had on the air many times, and I have a copy here, dated December the 8th, 1966, says that a man stopped in the office of an attorney in Las Vegas and advised that Nazi war criminal Mengele's was masquerading in this country. But the important thing is that the FBI blocks out the name of the people who informed them and the name of the FBI agent, but they have those names in Washington, so we could certainly ask them to do more work. It says Mengele's was naturalized on December the 5th, 1932, in the U.S. District Court in New York City under certificate number, and it's blacked out. The Los Angeles office has no information concerning the results of whether he was denaturalized. Now, if you wanted to solve this problem, if the Anti-Defamation League, if the Jewish organizations, if Simon Wiesenthal wanted to solve this problem, and they claim there's two Mengeles, they should come up with the Mengeles that the FBI man knew about. If he was naturalized, they have his date and they have his number. What country did he come from? Where did the other one come from that he was? That they want to take away his citizenship. If he got his naturalization citizenship in December of 32, he had to come from somewhere other than the United States. What territory on planet Earth did this man come from? And if they wanted to take away his citizenship, what state was the other Mengeles living in? Find what other state. And the third question is, where is he today? Where is the man today? And they can't come up with anybody but the German, like Dr. Urban, who was naturalized in San Francisco. He joined the Gestapo in Germany, came to the United States and was naturalized, then went back to Europe and recruited people like Errol Flynn and the Gestapo, rubbing off with Ronald Reagan at Warner Brothers. And the point is that they passed this off as dust because, one, the subject of denaturalization came, but, two, they have the actual when he was naturalized. Now, all you have to do is get the fingerprints and the basis of origin. Where did he come from? Peru in the 30s? No. What country? He came from Germany. That's where he came from, because I told you before, a friend of mine named David sat with him in the Honduras. I've said this over and over. Sat with him in the Honduras and sent for this memo. Now, Charles Spears in Texas transcribes these tapes on World Watchers and sends them to 30 or 40 or 50 people every week. And one of the recipients is Jack Anderson, who was on the board of the Reverend Moon Bank in Washington, D.C., and plays a good investigative role and then a backward role. He does sort of the backward step like Michael Jackson. Now, he gets a transcript of these tapes, and he knows from reading what Charles Beer sends him that I am telling you and the world about this particular Mengele. So when it turns out that he is in the United States and visiting, and Life magazine had an article about him visiting, and he is directly linked to Klaus Barbie and the cocaine traffic and the South American death squads of Licio Gelli, Anderson has the need or the order in return for documents that he prints and gets a reputation for having. He has to put down that this went to dust. This has never been investigated. The Jewish organizations have told me it's a different Mengele's, but they won't come up with any proof of any kind on the matter. Now, there's a few deaths I want to talk about this week, and then I said I'm going back next week onto the appointments. For those of you who have the tapes, the appointments of Ronald Reagan and continuing where I left off, and then the Henry Kissinger links to the British Nazi connections. Several weeks ago, on June the 11th, that was broadcast 653, I was talking about certain people who had died. One of them was Thomas Pillsbury, who worked on the Manhattan Project, who was swept away in a Colorado river, and who had bad feelings about the atomic bomb and was going to the Soviet Union to try to make peace, who had reversed feelings, who went swept away in a river. I also talked about Robert Boettcher, B-O-E-T-T-C-H-E-R, on the staff. He was the chief of the House investigation into Reverend Moon and Tongson Park. That I had the staff of congressional investigator of the South Korean scandal of Tongson Park from 1971 to 79, executive director of the Dance Theater of Harlem that fell out of a roof, Central Park. He was 44 years old. What I didn't make the connection, except from another person who told me, and I guess there's so much news, either I'm getting older or inundated with news or both, Boettcher is the fellow who wrote the book Gifts of Deceit, the book about Reverend Moon and their links to the government and their organizations and to the Central Intelligence Agency. I didn't make the connection, and thanks to a very astute listener, they reminded me, and I do have the book. There are people like Mr. Blair, who wrote about the oil conspiracy, who died within weeks of when the book came out. Mr. Borkin, who wrote The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Foreman, died right after the book came out. I'm doing a series of authors, attorneys, judges, congressional investigators, CIA. A man like this falls into three or four classifications. In Gifts of Deceit, the book is described, it describes Boettcher as a staff of the House Subcommittee on International Relations. He was in on the Korean scandal. He was in liaison with top officials of the CIA, the Department of State, the Justice, Special Counsel Leon Jaworski, who's from the Warren Commission, and was on the Ethics Committee, the staff of the Ethics Committee investigation. He also was expert in Far Eastern languages at Georgetown University and worked 5 years in the Foreign Service with Donald Fraser, congressman from Minneapolis, who was Minnesota, who was defeated by the Moon people who ganged up on him. He was an expert on Reverend Moon. He is described, when I read back on the book and looked into the book, he was the one who made the connections to the Korean CIA, to our CIA, to the support of Richard Nixon, and the meddling in U.S. policies and Moon's front organizations and his breaking the First Amendment freedoms. And he was showing out how millions of dollars were put into political action by a man from Korea, South Korea, who was affecting our right of the Constitution for free speech. And he was talking about the chance of bribery and corruption and coercion repeated again because it's woven into the fabric of our society in Washington right now. Now, that's the fellow, just to update that story that I had. He passed away flying out of a building, like so many people, Ralph Bunche and a lot of other important people that fly out of buildings. One, another death that you might have read this week, Representative Carl Perkins, a veteran liberal, dies at age 71. He was the most important liberal in the Congress, a very quiet man. You didn't know him. He was chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee since 1967. The San Francisco Chronicle says he was one of the strongest committee chairmen in all of Congress. He devoted his entire energy into recent years to fighting the budget cuts proposed by President Reagan. Perkins' success succeeded in some instances and lost in the other. He said, "I worked for years for the welfare of people, and now the Reagan administration is tearing it apart. I'm seeing practically everything dismantled. I'm not just going to vote to destroy these programs." He says, "That is what they want to do, and I'm not going to let them do it. I'm going to fight it." Well, he was on an airplane going, he's from Lexington, Kentucky. He was going to Washington. He got sick on the plane. He didn't feel good. He arrived dead in Washington, D.C. He's a person who was up for re-election. It's an election year. His seat was open. He was running without Republican opposition. Remember when John Warner won a seat in the Senate after the plane crash of the man who defeated him in the primary, and he's been in the very important position in the Senate ever since, next-door neighbor to Edwin Wilson, who devoted himself to making the missiles that down airplanes for airplane crashes, and Frank Turple expertised himself with chemicals you put on the arms or clothing of people, particularly walking down the aisle of an airplane, and they drop dead, it gets into the blood system, and they have what's an apparent heart attack. Well, he was delivered dead on arrival as chairman of the important committee, and he worked hard. Some of the things he did are legislation for aid to schools, not religious schools, other schools, college student assistance, child nutrition, coal mine safety, aid to the crippled children, labor measures, the first labor for the coal miners in his area. He dropped dead just this past week, and he will be missed in Congress, a very quiet man who seemed to be getting his work done. Another quiet man who died at a convention with a bunch of people in Paris, Gilbert Renault, R-E-N-A-U-L-T. He was the organizer of the Free French Intelligence Against Claus Barbie, who's still sitting there for 2 years and hasn't gone to trial. He died of an apparent heart attack on the time he attended an anniversary with the resistance fighters who fought against the Nazis in France. He didn't show up at the party, the breakfast meeting, and they went to his hotel room and he was dead. In 1948, he wrote a book, Memoirs of a Secret Agent of Free France. He used the alias, or the pseudonym Remy, R-E-M-Y. Probably in 1948, he knew that the Nazis still had death squads, and he wrote it under an assumed name and didn't feel free then. He went to England and during the war, and then came back and worked the cloak and dagger work. He went behind the lines and provided intelligence, saw many of his friends killed. He was a banking executive who went to a reunion of his buddies and was dead at the time of the reunion. Sure, he's 79. He's a nice, ripe age, but it's a time of the Claus Barbie trial coming up. Mr. Perkins was 71. But a lot of those water gators you see, those villains, they'll live to be a ripe old age and not dying of these apparent heart attacks at a time that they're an important meeting. Just when a trial is coming up, there's an election coming up, and Bergens is running for the House of Representatives again, a clear winner, and he dies, and a clear opponent of everything Reagan stands for. And again, at a time when the Nazis are getting a foothold, a fighter of the resistance goes to Reunion, the leader of the resistance, and he's dead. Now, the next man who died this last week wasn't killed, and he's no hero. He's Colonel Edward Glavin, G-L-A-V-I-N, but a very important man. He died. He was 81 years old and died last Wednesday in a hospital in Norwalk, Connecticut. They didn't give the reason, but I'm sure this one wasn't murdered. He attended West Point University, and then he went to London, and it's very important, this school, Balliol College, B-A-L-L-I-O-L, College at Oxford, is very important for American espionage, and then he went on to be a military attaché at the American Embassy in London. Now, Colonel Glavin was the man in charge of negotiating the secret surrender that I talked about in the first part of this program, where the Nazis are getting rid of their atomic bombs and their intelligence to work for the United States. He helped with the surrender of 1 million troops in northern Italy to the United States. He delivered May 2nd, 1945, from SS Karl Wolf, who was running the Treblinka concentration camps while he was working with Alan Dulles, both in the OSS, Glavin and Dulles in the OSS. Dulles later on the Warren Commission with John McCloy. Always going back to the Kennedy assassinations, whether it's Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger with the atomic bomb and the plans for the next war, Reinhard Gehlen's agents in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, or Mr. Glavin making the secret surrender with Wolf and Alan Dulles, again, on the Warren Commission with the Kennedy. This was America's real coup. Now, the importance of this man is not only was he instrumental in being the liaison between SS Karl Wolf, who Wolf was the man, the go-between between Adolf Hitler and Mr. Heinrich Himmler, but he went on after the war. He was placed with the United States Army Information Service in Frankfurt, Germany, in the Army Education Program of the United States. This is the New York Times. There were other obituaries, but nobody stated it so well as the New York Times. He worked for the United States Army Education Program at Frankfurt, Germany. Parts of the program had the goal of raising the education level of United States troops and to make them aware that the war was over and that, in quotes, hate Germans attitude or personal retribution against Germans would no longer be tolerated in the United States Army. This is when they're opening up Dachau or Treblinka that SS Karl Wolf from the secret surrender was running at the time he was working with this very man. His role, the American role, was to teach the GIs who saw what was going on. This may have been the largest mass brainwashing of American troops to not repulse them against what they saw as against what they should feel. He was to make them aware that it would not be tolerated to hate Germans, and that was immediately after the war in Frankfurt, Germany, while Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger were over there instructing the top Nazis on how to get ready to work for the United States government and then get out to South America if they need be with the OSS and the CIA money. Now, after he retired in 1955, he went on to work for New York University, the college fundraising, coincidentally, Norman Redlich, the Warren Commission counsel, is now chief of law school at New York University. If you raise enough money for the university and you want certain people to run the law department, just like Mr. Liebler is the head of the law department, one of the professors or the head of the law department at UCLA, the attorneys from the Warren Commission in strategic places. Now, another murder that I want to discuss, and getting back close to home, it was in the San Jose Mercury this week, August the 2nd. Reputed Hawaiian hitman pleads guilty to 4 murders. And I bring this in because this is a current murder. Honolulu, a hitman state that he killed 4 people, among them a state senator and the son of a city prosecutor. He killed Charles Marshland III, the 19-year-old son of Honolulu prosecuting attorney Charles F. Marshland Jr. So the target, for one of the four murders for the mafia in Hawaii was a state senator and the son of a man who was prosecuting for the city. So you see, if I have feelings about going off the air at this time, I can relate to what I read in the paper, that they do in fact hit sons. If you don't believe it, read your morning paper. Now, I want one other article, if I have time to get on, from the Washington Post. We'll do that quickly, and then I'll tell you how you can obtain tapes of these broadcasts. I will be making them, and they will be going out. You send me a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope to May Brussel, P.O. Box 22511, Carmel 93922. And I will tell you how to get the tapes and how to pool. If there's one or two or three or four people that want to spend a dollar a week and to pool their money, you can obtain these broadcasts. I don't know how long I'll be off the air. I don't know what the pressures are. In the last few weeks, there have been pressures here. I was taking the tape of the broadcast that I take as soon as I'm off the air and leave it at the tape center on Forest Avenue, two blocks away. And several weeks ago, at 9 in the evening, where there's about one car every minute on that street, it's not a major thoroughfare, there was a man directly in front of the tape center, a large, heavyset man. It looked like that Mr. Keneally from the Nazi party that I'd seen in L.A., that type, a leather jacket, mean-looking, about 45 years old, and his arms were crossed, and the slot that I put the tapes in at the door was, he just completely covered the door waiting, and I pulled up. And it happened that my son, the one that got the death threats, was meeting me for dinner about three blocks up the street that evening. And I motioned to him, and we went on and parked my car somewhere, went back, and he was still there. We went out to dinner somewhere else and came back, and he was gone. There was somebody in the lobby here at the station a few weeks ago, sort of, it looked like an E. Howard Hunt hobo down at the bottom of the stairs, and I didn't know whether to come back to the station or go on to the car, and I went to the car and waited, and later he had this package of stuff that was laid out all over the floor, and he sort of ran down the street and left. I guess he thought I might stay there forever, and I was willing to do that, but there's been some weird things going on, so the phone call alone would be reason enough to stop, but I want to mention that there have been other things going on. Now, finally, there is an article in the Washington Post, July 23rd, Doctors Postmortem. It's about Dr. Dixon, Dr. Douglas Dixon of Washington, D.C. It says he's the fifth Washington medical examiner to leave the city in the last 18 months. He said he was resigning because of political considerations. He said he's forced to say suicides are accidents, to have autopsies where none that warranted. And once when he wanted an autopsy on the murder of a rabbi in Washington, D.C., recently murdered, they wouldn't let him do it. The office wouldn't let him do it. He said, there was a time during the day when the rabbi was murdered when I was prepared to take off my gloves and walk out, resigning not only the acting chief but as deputy medical examiner in protest over what are extremely dangerous meddling examples in Washington, D.C. Now, that's the city where I said when Reagan was to be president, the murders would be rampant, and if you listen every week, you know they are. He said he's leaving this office. There's three positions have been vacant out of six. They've been political positions. People have left there and walked out. The deputies have walked out of this office. Now, if the good guys leave, they will totally control the politics of the autopsies in Washington, D.C., which is what they want to do. And I mentioned the murder of the Sinfuels investigator, Mr. Thomas Doherty, May the 6th, 1984, how he was killed and found in the river there, the Potomac River, Chesapeake Bay. No, it's the Potomac River that he was found floating in. And there was questions about his death. And he was the prime investigator that caused the head of the Sinfuel organization to retire under investigation of financial mismanagements. Well, be kind, there were many millions of dollars missing out of a bank he was involved with in Oklahoma. But the chief investigator, Mr. Doherty, was found floating in the river. And this man says that the coroner's office in Washington, D.C. has become so political, and after the murder of the rabbi, he wanted to walk out. Well, the time is up. We've got to go now. I see it. Oh, not time for the blues? Or are you doing the blues for us? Okay, well, this is Mae Brussel. It's KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove. I'm about 1 minute over, so we'll close. For those of you who want to subscribe, you can take the tapes. It won't be live on the air for a while, but I will have a program of records so you can keep listening next week.